A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He wants to talk about the hidden world of custom picture framing. What actually happens when you bring a piece of art to a framer, from mount selection through to glass choice? Where demand for bespoke framing lives today? How many shops are left in the US and Europe? And what separates a truly great framer from someone who just cuts wood? There's a lot here.
A $15 IKEA frame and a $400 custom frame both hold a picture. But one is engineered to be disposable. The other is designed to preserve a piece of history for centuries. And that's not marketing language, that's material science.
The global framing market is projected at $12.3 billion this year. But custom framing share has been shrinking for a decade. Meanwhile, the number of master framers in Europe has dropped below 2,000.
Below 2,000. That's fewer master framers than there are professional competitive eaters in the United States.
Of course you know that number.
I looked it up. It's roughly 3,000 competitive eaters.
Let's start with the obvious question. What is custom framing, and why does it cost 10 to 20 times what a factory frame costs?
We're not talking about the frames you grab off a shelf at a big box store. We're talking about the bespoke process. Measuring, cutting, joining, mounting, glazing. All done by a trained craftsperson who's looking at your specific piece of art. The frame is built around the art, not the other way around.
The core tension here is that custom framing is a luxury service in a world that is optimized for cheap, flat pack, standardized everything. But the value proposition is fundamentally different. It's preservation versus decoration.
A factory frame says, hang this on the wall for a few years and toss it. A custom frame says your grandchildren will argue over who gets this.
Who still pays for this?
That's actually the interesting question. It's not just rich collectors. It's anyone who owns something they want to last. An original painting, a signed print, a family photograph from the 1940s, a wedding ketubah, a diploma they actually care about. The customer base is broader than people assume.
Narrower than it used to be.
We'll get to that. But first, to understand the price tag, you have to understand what's actually inside a frame, and what happens when the wrong materials are used.
Take us there.
Framing as a craft goes back to the 15th century. The earliest frames weren't afterthoughts. They were carved architectural elements, often more expensive than the paintings they held. Altarpiece frames in Renaissance Italy were gilded, carved, inlaid. The frame was part of the artwork's sacred function.
The frame as halo.
Then you get the arts and crafts movement in the late 19th century. William Morris, the Pre-Raphaelites. They revived handmade moldings, hand-carved ornament, the idea that the frame should be in dialogue with the art rather than just containing it.
Then World War II ends and everything changes.
Post-war manufacturing explodes. Mass production of picture frames becomes viable. Extruded aluminium, injection molded plastic, particle board with foil wrap. The frame becomes a commodity. By the 1970s, you got frame departments in every department store.
Now we have IKEA selling 12 million frames a year globally. 12 million frames designed for a 3 to 5 year lifespan.
The backing is MDF, medium density fiberboard, which off-gasses acids. The glass blocks may be 40% of UV light. The paper mat yellows in 5 to 7 years. The molding is particle board with a foil veneer that peels if you look at it wrong. These are not frames. These are temporary holding devices.
The cardboard sleeve of home decor.
They've trained an entire generation to see framing as a commodity, not a craft. People walk into IKEA, see a frame for $15, and think, why would I pay $300? They don't know what they're not getting.
Let's talk about what they're not getting. What's actually happening inside a frame that can destroy an artwork in 10 years if it's done wrong?
Three main killers. Acid migration, UV damage, and improper mounting. Let me walk through each one.
Start with acid.
Most paper contains lignin. It's the natural polymer that binds wood fibers together. Lignin is unstable. Over time, it breaks down and releases acids. Those acids migrate into whatever's touching the paper, in this case, your artwork. You get yellowing, brittleness, brown spots called foxing. It's irreversible.
Acid-free matting is the first line of defense.
Acid-free isn't just a marketing term. It means two specific things. First, the mat board is made from purified cellulose or cotton fiber, not wood pulp. Second, it's buffered with calcium carbonate, basically chalk, which neutralizes any acids that do form over time. The buffer typically lasts about 50 to 100 years.
Which is longer than most marriages?
The second killer is UV light. Ultraviolet radiation breaks down the chemical bonds in pigments and paper fibers. Watercolors are especially vulnerable. A few years in direct sunlight behind standard glass, and your painting looks like a faded t-shirt.
What's the difference between standard glass and museum glass?
Standard glass blocks about 40% of UV light. Basic UV filtering glass blocks 70 to 75%. Museum-grade glass, the stuff from companies like TrueView or Art Glass, blocks 99%.
It's invisible.
That's the wild part. Museum glass has anti-reflective coatings that make it nearly invisible. You walk up to a frame and you genuinely can't tell there's glass there. The coating uses the same principle as anti-reflective coatings on camera lenses. Destructive interference of light waves.
You're paying for something you literally cannot see.
That's the paradox of conservation framing. Most of what you're paying for is invisible. The acid-free mat looks like a mat. The museum glass looks like nothing. The reversible mounting is hidden behind the artwork. You're paying for the absence of future damage.
Like buying insurance where the premium is paid in aesthetics.
Then there's the third killer, improper mounting. This is where a lot of damage happens. The classic mistake is dry mounting.
Explain dry mounting.
Dry mounting is when you use heat-activated adhesive to permanently bond the artwork to a backing board. It's fast, it's flat, it looks great, and it's completely irreversible. If that artwork is a signed print, a limited edition, or anything with resale value, dry mounting destroys its value.
Because you can never separate it from the board.
And the adhesive itself can yellow and become acidic over time, so you've permanently bonded your artwork to a material that's slowly destroying it.
What's the right way?
Conservation mounting uses reversible techniques. The gold standard is hinging with Japanese paper and wheat starch paste. You create small paper hinges that attach the artwork to the backing, and the paste is water soluble. It can be removed decades later without damaging the artwork. No adhesive touches the art itself.
Japanese paper specifically?
Japanese paper, washi, is made from long-fibered plant materials like kozo or gampi. It's incredibly strong, acid-free, and the fibers are long enough that the paper doesn't degrade the way wood pulp paper does. A good framer has sheets of this stuff and knows exactly how to tear it. You never cut it with scissors, you tear it so the feathered edge blends into the mount.
This is the level of detail we're talking about.
Then there's the mat overhang. The conservation standard is what's called the 2-inch rule. The mat should extend at least 2 inches beyond the artwork on all sides. That creates enough distance between the artwork and the frame itself to prevent acid migration from the molding.
The mat isn't just decorative.
The mat is a buffer zone. It's a chemical and physical barrier. A framer who doesn't understand this is just a box maker.
Let's talk about the anatomy of a custom frame. Molding, joinery, backing. What are we actually looking at?
The molding is the frame profile, the shaped wood or composite that forms the visible border. Moldings come in thousands of profiles, from simple flat rectangles to elaborate multi-step shapes with carved ornament. A good framer has a wall of sample corners, little L-shaped pieces you hold up against the art to see how the frame reads.
The material matters.
Solid wood moldings, maple, walnut, cherry, ash, are the premium option. They're stable, they take finish well, they can be carved or routed into complex profiles. Then you have composite moldings, basically MDF with a painted or foil-wrapped finish. They're cheaper, they're consistent, but they're heavier and they can't be repaired if they chip.
Then there's gilded frames.
That's a whole separate craft. Traditional gilding involves applying layers of gesso, a chalk and glue mixture, to carved wood, then burnishing it smooth, then applying a clay-based bowl, then laying down sheets of gold leaf with a gilder's tip. 23-karat gold leaf is about a tenth of a micron thick. You breathe on it wrong and it disappears.
The breath test is quality control.
A single gilded frame can take 40 hours of labor. There's a framer in Paris who specializes in 19th century gilded frames. He sources antique moldings from demolished buildings and re-gilds them by hand. A single frame can cost over 2,000 euros.
That's before you even get to the joinery.
The joinery is where the corners come together. A mitered corner, cut at a 45-degree angle, is the standard, but how that corner is joined makes a huge difference. The best frames use hand-cut miters, which are more precise than machine-cut because the framer can adjust for slight variations in the molding. The corners are then joined with an underpinner, a pneumatic tool that drives V-shaped metal fasteners into the back of the frame.
Not glue alone.
Glue alone will fail. Wood expands and contracts with humidity. Over time, a glue-only corner will separate. The underpinner creates a mechanical bond that holds even as the wood moves.
The backing system?
Three main options. Foam core is the budget choice. It's lightweight, it's acid-free if you get the right kind, but it can warp in humidity. Coroplast is corrugated plastic. It's waterproof, rigid, and archival. Acid-free conservation board is the premium option for museum-grade work. The backing is sealed with a dust cover, a sheet of craft paper glued to the back of the frame that keeps dust and insects out. Silverfish love paper. They'll eat right through a mat and into your artwork. A sealed dust cover stops them.
We've got acid-free matting, museum glass, reversible mounting, solid wood moldings, underpin corners, sealed backing. This is a piece of engineering.
It's a micro-environment. A well-built frame creates a stable climate around the artwork. Controlled humidity, no acid migration, minimal UV exposure, physical protection. It's basically a life support system for paper.
Which brings us to a case study. 1920s lithograph, brought into a framer's shop. It's been in a cheap frame for decades, and it's got tape stains.
This is a classic restoration scenario. The tape, probably old masking tape, or what framers call permanent tape, has been stuck to the paper for decades. The adhesive has turned yellow, it's become brittle, and it's stained the paper fibers. A bad framer tries to peel it off and tears the paper. A good framer uses a controlled humidification chamber. It's essentially a sealed container with a precisely controlled humidity level. The artwork is placed inside, and the moisture softens the old adhesive without saturating the paper. Over several hours, sometimes days, the tape can be gently lifted away. Then the framer uses a poultice to draw any remaining adhesive residue out of the paper fibers.
That's not framing, that's surgery.
It's why a great framer needs to understand paper chemistry, adhesive chemistry, and the physics of humidity. This is not a job you learn from a YouTube tutorial.
That's the technical side. But the real story here is economics. Who's still paying for this? And why is the industry shrinking?
Let me give you the numbers. In the United States, there were roughly 6,800 custom framing shops in 2010. As of 2025, that number is down to about 4,200. That's a 38% decline in 15 years. Approximately 3,500 shops across Europe. Germany leads with about 900, the UK with about 750, France around 600. But the Fine Art Trade Guild, the UK and European certification body, reports fewer than 2,000 certified master framers on the continent. That's down from over 3,000 a decade ago.
What's driving the decline?
Big box craft stores. Michaels, Hobby Lobby in the US, offering custom framing. That's really just semi-custom. They have pre-cut moldings, limited glass options, and employees who got 2 weeks of training. But their prices are 40 to 60% lower than an independent framer.
Most customers can't tell the difference.
Most customers don't know there is a difference. They see a frame on the wall, it looks fine, the price is right. They're not thinking about what's happening inside that frame over the next 20 years. Online-only competitors. FrameBridge, Simply Framed, Level Frames. The model is simple. They ship you a box. You mail in your art. They frame it in a centralized facility. They ship it back. FrameBridge has raised $58 million in venture funding.
They've never turned a profit.
Because the economics of centralized custom framing are brutal. They use pre-cut moldings and standard sizes to keep costs down, which means they can't handle non-standard pieces. They can't do the design consultation that a local framer does, holding up different mats and moldings against the actual artwork. They're essentially a factory that calls itself custom.
The WeWork of picture framing.
That's not unfair, But the third force is the biggest one, IKEA. 12 million frames a year. They've trained a generation to see framing as a commodity, and their frames are fine for what they are. If you've got a poster from a concert you went to last summer, put it in an IKEA frame. It'll look great for 3 to 5 years.
The problem is, when people put their grandmother's wedding photo in an IKEA frame,
in 30 years, that photo is yellow, brittle, and acid-burned, and the negative doesn't exist anymore. That's the quiet tragedy. Millions of irreplaceable pieces being slowly destroyed by cheap materials, and nobody knows it's happening until it's too late.
Where does demand for custom framing actually live right now?
It's bifurcating. At the high end, you've got the fine art market. Galleries, collectors, museums. They'll always need conservation framing. A painting that sells for $50,000 gets a frame that costs $2,000 to $5,000. That's just the cost of doing business.
At the other end?
People who inherited something. A letter, a photograph, a piece of embroidery, and want to preserve it. They're not art collectors. They're just people who understand that some things can't be replaced.
The middle is disappearing.
The middle is getting eaten by Michaels and Framebridge. The person who wants a nice frame for their diploma or their kid's artwork, they're going to the big box store or going online. The independent framer who relied on that middle market is struggling.
What makes a great framer, beyond the technical skills we've talked about?
The technical skills are table stakes. What separates a great framer is design judgment. The ability to look at a piece and make decisions about matte color, molding profile, fillet choice, decisions that complement the artwork without competing with it. A fillet is a thin decorative molding that goes inside the frame, between the mat and the molding. It adds depth, creates a transition. A gold fillet against a dark wood frame, framing a 19th century engraving, it can elevate the whole piece, but it has to be chosen carefully. A bad fillet choice looks like you put a necklace on a dog.
The framer as stylist.
The best framers have a visual vocabulary built from handling thousands of pieces. They've seen what works and what doesn't. They know that a wide white mat with a thin black frame reads as contemporary. They know that a warm gold molding with a cream mat reads as traditional. They know that a floating mount, where the artwork is raised above the mat rather than overlapped by it, works for deckled edge paper because it shows off the irregular edge. The rough, feathered edge of handmade paper. Covering it with a mat is a crime. A great framer knows that.
They also know when to say no.
That's actually one of the most important things. A great framer will refuse to dry mount a signed print. They'll refuse to trim an artwork to fit a standard frame size. They'll refuse to use non-UV glass on a watercolor. They're willing to lose a sale rather than damage a piece.
The framer is ethical gatekeeper.
They'll educate the customer. Here's why I'm recommending museum glass for this piece. Here's what will happen if we use standard glass. Here's the cost difference, and here's why it's worth it. A great framer is a teacher as much as a craftsperson.
Let's talk about cost breakdown. What are you actually paying for in a custom frame?
For a typical 16 by 20 custom frame in the US, you're looking at $180 to $350. In Europe, it's 150 to 400 euros depending on the country. The molding is 30 to 40% of the total cost. Glass or acrylic is 20 to 25%. Labor is 25 to 30%. Matting is 10 to 15%.
When someone says, it's just wood and glass, they're missing the labor and the expertise.
They're also missing the materials quality. The molding on a $400 frame is solid hardwood, not foil-wrapped particle board. The glass is optically coated, not float glass. The mat is cotton rag, not wood pulp. Every component is an upgrade.
What separates a $150 frame from a $600 frame when the dimensions are the same?
Molding, solid wood versus composite, simple profile versus carved or gilded. Glass, standard UV versus museum grade anti-reflective. Mounting, dry mount versus conservation hinging. And labor, machine cut miters in a factory versus hand cut miters by a craftsperson who's been doing this for 20 years.
The labor component is interesting because it's the one thing that can't be automated away.
CNC routing can cut moldings, but it can't choose them. An AI could suggest matte colors based on color theory, but it can't hold a physical sample against the artwork and see how the light plays across it. But that's the question the industry is grappling with. As CNC routing and AI-driven design tools become cheaper, will we see a kind of bespoke automation that brings custom framing costs down? Or will the craft become a luxury reserved for the top 1% of art owners?
I think the answer is both. Automation will handle the middle, semi-custom frames that are better than IKEA, but not truly bespoke, and the high-end will survive, because there's always someone willing to pay for the best.
The generational shift complicates this. Younger buyers, Gen Z, younger millennials, are more likely to frame concert posters and digital art prints than heirlooms. They're framing ephemera. The emotional attachment is different. A signed Taylor Swift poster matters to you now, but will your grandchildren want it?
They'll want the NFT of it.
But the point stands. The industry has to adapt to framing objects that aren't meant to last centuries. That changes the value proposition. You don't need museum glass for a concert poster you might replace in 5 years.
The industry might split into 3 tiers. Disposable frames for temporary displays. IKEA owns this. Semi-custom for the middle. Online framers and big box stores. And true conservation framing for the high end and the sentimental pieces.
The independent framer who tries to compete in the middle tier is getting squeezed out. The ones who survive are either at the very high end or they've diversified. They do restoration, they do shadow boxes for memorabilia, they do mirror framing, they do installation.
Shadow boxes are a whole other world.
Framing three-dimensional objects, jerseys, medals, instruments, artifacts, requires an entirely different skill set. You're building a custom depth frame, you're creating mounts that hold objects without adhesives touching them, you're dealing with different conservation issues. A football jersey has different degradation risks than a watercolor.
If someone's listening to this and thinking about that print they've been meaning to frame, what do they actually need to know?
3 questions to ask any framer before you hand over your artwork. 1. Do you use acid-free, lignin-free matting? If they hesitate, walk out. 2. Do you hinge or dry mount? If they say dry mount and don't explain why that might be a problem, walk out. 3. What UV rating is your glass? If they can't give you a number, walk out.
That's a good checklist.
If you own something worth preserving, original art, signed prints, family photos from before 1960, never use a standard frame from a big box store. The cost of conservation framing is a fraction of the cost of restoration later. Oxene restorers charge $500 to fix acid burn that could have been prevented with a $30 acid-free mat.
The IKEA frame is fine for posters and temporary displays. But if you want something to outlast you, budget 3 to 5 times what you'd spend on a factory frame and find a framer who's a member of the Professional Picture Framers Association in the US or the Fine Art Trade Guild in the UK and Europe.
When you walk into a good framer shop, pay attention to what's on the walls. Look at their own framing. Look at the molding samples. Look at the work they have in progress. A great framer shop is a gallery of their taste.
The framer as curator.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1930s, a British colonial administrator in Niger attempted to introduce Eton Fives to the local population. The project was abandoned after 6 months because the specially constructed courts, built from imported English brick, crumbled in the heat before a single match could be played. The courts were repurposed as goat pens.
The British Empire, in one fact.
But the bigger question, the one nobody in the industry has answered yet, is where this craft goes next. We're watching a 400-year-old tradition get compressed between IKEA on one side and venture-funded online framers on the other.
The generational question is the one I keep coming back to. When younger buyers are framing concert posters and digital art prints, things designed to be ephemeral, does the very concept of preservation framing become obsolete for anyone outside the fine art world?
I don't think it becomes obsolete, but I think it becomes niche in a way it wasn't before. Custom framing used to be something middle-class families did for their wedding photos, their diplomas, their children's portraits. That market is gone, and it's not coming back.
What replaces it?
May do we just accept that most things aren't meant to last? That the family photo lives on a phone, not on a wall. That the diploma is a PDF. That the art print is replaced every few years when tastes change.
That's a bleak vision.
Or maybe the pendulum swings back. Maybe there's a generation that grows up surrounded by disposable everything and starts craving permanence. A vinyl record revival, but for picture frames.
The hipster framer, handlebar mustache, self-edged denim apron, only uses hand-forged nails.
I'd watch that YouTube channel.
Seriously, a great frame doesn't just hold a picture. It tells a story about what we value enough to preserve. And in a world where everything is increasingly temporary, the decision to frame something properly is a decision to say, this matters.
That's the part the industry needs to communicate better. Custom framing isn't a luxury purchase. It's a statement of values. It's saying, this piece of paper, this photograph, this painting, it deserves to outlast me.
That's worth more than $15 at IKEA.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. This has been My Weird Prompts. Find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.